From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. So what is true in the escalating war of words over Ukraine? This week, President Trump is scheduled to meet in New York during the UN General Assembly with Ukraine's new president. Over the weekend, President Trump admitted he did have a conversation last July with him about Trump's political rival, Joe Biden.
The conversation I had was largely congratulatory, was largely corruption, all of the corruption taking place, was largely the fact that we don't want our people, like Vice President Biden and his son, creating to the corruption already in the Ukraine.
But the Wall Street Journal reported that the president actually pressured Ukraine to investigate Biden 8 times on that July phone call. And Trump's lawyer Rudy Giuliani says Biden sought to fire the prosecutor who was investigating the Ukrainian company whose board Biden's son Hunter served on, implying the company sought to seek protection against the prosecutor's investigation by hiring Biden Jr. Well, then on Saturday, the Trump campaign released sound of Biden last year, telling the Council on Foreign Relations that as vice president, he did successfully force the firing of the Ukrainian prosecutor by threatening to withhold $1 billion in U.S. loan guarantees. Let's listen.
I said, you're not getting the billion. I'm going to be leaving here. And I think it was, 6 hours? I looked, I said, I'm leaving in 6 hours. If the prosecutor's not fired, you're not getting the money.
And Biden noted that then the prosecutor was soon voted out by the Ukrainian parliament. But Biden was far from the only voice calling for his ouster. In fact, the Obama administration was supporting other investigations into the oligarch who owned the company that Biden Jr. worked at. They just felt this prosecutor was looking for bribes instead of justice. Confused? Let's bring in Dustin Volz of the Wall Street Journal, part of the team that first reported the details of the president's call with the Ukrainian president. And Dustin, Biden supporters say, in fact, they wanted the prosecutor to better investigate the oligarch who owned the company that Biden Jr. was on the board of. Trump says Biden got rid of the prosecutor to protect the company his son was on the board of. What is true about this Ukrainian prosecutor who was fired?
Well, there's a lot to unpack here, Robin.
Yeah.
And yeah, I think it's good to just take a step back and remember that when Joe Biden was serving as vice president in the Obama administration, Ukraine was part of his portfolio, and he was working on trying to root out corruption broadly in the country. And you know, the United States was not the only country at the time that thought Ukraine had a corruption problem. So the ouster of the prosecutor general in question here, it's not something that Biden was sort of alone in demanding. It was something that other nations and other entities agreed there was corruption and that this prosecutor needed to go.
And the New York Times reports there were accusations of money laundering, tax evasion, especially when this prosecutor was head of a ministry during the Russian-backed reign of the former president, Viktor Yanukovych, who left in disgrace. So this was, it sounds like this was part of a cleanup of that corruption.
Right. And that's certainly what the Biden campaign is pushing out and saying, look, this was the former vice president doing his job, trying to help reform Ukraine. The Trump administration and allies of President Trump want to connect the dots here and say that Joe Biden's son, Hunter, and his service on the board of this Ukrainian energy company, which had come under investigation by the prosecutor, that that was in some way what motivated the ouster of that prosecutor. But there's no evidence that that's the case. A lot of news organizations have looked into that, and there have not been any clear links saying Joe Biden pushed for this guy's removal, this prosecutor's removal, to help his son, Hunter.
But should Hunter Biden have stepped down just because of the optics? Were there calls for that?
I think this is a question that is often comes up in Washington in these types of discussions, right, is, you know, whether or not there was actual wheeling and dealing or some sort of malicious intent on the activities here, the knowledge of the optics, should this have been avoided? This is certainly something that came up, you know, with Hillary Clinton in the 2016 campaign with her emails, right? I mean, there was sort of this discussion about whether or not it was actually leading to the disclosure of classified information or if it was nefarious in any way. Surely she should have known that there was an optics issue here, right? And so, you know, in a lot of voters' minds, and that's important as well. And I think that's something that people are going to have to sort out themselves.
Well, of course, there's an irony because the president's children all work in areas of the family business that some say could be bad optics and conflict with different policies. But putting that aside, fast forward to today. Trump is trying to say Biden influenced an investigation in Ukraine, which, again, something that's been investigated and found not to be true. Democrats are saying President Trump broke the law by asking a foreign country to investigate his political rival. And Adam Schiff, who's chair of the House Intelligence Committee, is saying that the Department of Justice has to turn over the transcripts of this phone call that the president had or transcripts of the whistleblower's claim who's made this public. Trump defenders say that would mean no president would ever talk to a world leader. But also on Fox and Friends this morning, the host repeatedly said that according to reports they were reading, the U.S. government can't release the whistleblower's complaint about this to Congress, as the Democrats are demanding, because the whistleblower's claim is based on a rumor, not something the whistleblower heard directly say in a phone call the president made. Do we know any more about that?
We're continuing to report on sort of the whistleblower and the substance of those allegations that are contained in that report. You know, certainly this is something that is continuing to be fought over in Congress. Both, you know, you see Democrats wanting the release of both the transcript of the call and the whistleblower complaint. We do know that the complaint involves details of this call as a sort of a broader concern that was brought forth by this member of the intelligence community. And so, you know, this is going to play out this week in Congress as the acting director of national intelligence, Joseph McGuire, actually appears before both the Senate and House intelligence committees over this issue. It's unclear if he will be able to divulge any further information than what we have currently, but this issue is not going away. And to your point about President Trump and his family, I mean, he's sort of in an interesting spot where we saw him over the weekend say, of course, Joe Biden talked to his son about his business dealings, but President Trump and his sons have many businesses around the world. And, you know, one thing we've heard from him is that he doesn't talk about those issues with his son. So you sort of see both sides getting increasingly enmeshed and contorted with how they're trying to explain this incredibly complicated story.
Oh, it is a Russian doll. Dustin Bolt of The Wall Street Journal, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, today, hundreds of thousands of tourists around the world are trying to figure out what to do after the sudden collapse of the British company Thomas Cook, which calls itself the world's oldest travel company. The company was looking for an injection of cash and didn't get it and shut down operations early this morning. Joining us now is the BBC's Gavin Lee, who's in the resort destination of Palma, Spain. Gavin, what have you been seeing there?
Well, coachloads of people came off at the airport this morning. Very frustrated, some looking very confused at the end of their holiday. And there was a line of people in yellow jackets, and they were from this organization called the Civil Aviation Authority that have come in after the insolvency of Thomas Cook, trying to reassure people. But the issue was, they were saying to people, we have flown out specially to help you get home, and other airlines are stepping in to help out, but you will not be on the same flight. You may be on a flight, let's say in the UK, you go up to Scotland, up to Glasgow. Well, actually, they may fly you to Gatwick, which is near London. You're talking about a 12-hour drive from there, or coach journey. So people are still packed at the airport right now. The whole of the departures terminal, there are hundreds upon hundreds of people all sitting, some sleeping right now, waiting for a very late flight out tonight. The plan is, they call it Operation Matterhorn, after one of the highest peaks in the Alps, which was seen as one of the big zenith mountains to climb. This is a huge mountain to climb for the emergency operation for the next 2 weeks. Every day is going to be like this.
Well, and these are people who have booked package tours. They might not be so keen to try to figure everything out themselves when they get back to London and have to get all the way back to Scotland or whatever. Why did Thomas Cook go under, though, Gavin?
It's a good point, Jeremy. One thing that they talk about is Brexit, and they talk about how many people were staying in the UK, worried about this constant Brexit effect about whether or not to go on holiday. And Thomas Cook's the oldest travel agency in the UK, in fact, one of the oldest in the world, you know, back to 1841. You know, Thomas Cook himself was setting off on excursions to Loughborough in the East Midlands of the UK. And quite ironic, we were talking to people trying to get back to Loughborough in the East Midlands in the UK on the very last flight. They blame Brexit. They blame the heat wave. You and I have spoke about that before. In Europe over the summer and last summer, fewer people traveling because of the heat wave in their own countries. And also Turkey. You know, we're talking about hundreds of thousands of people every month flying to Antalya Airport in Turkey. Because of the instability, the issue with Syria there, they say many people have stopped traveling to a big part of their destination. And you know, those flights for Orlando as well, this big emergency situation there with people trying to get back to the UK as part of that wider operation. So those three main factors are given as the reason. And just as I'm talking to you now, I can see there is a just from this beach, you can see the runway itself, and there's a fleet at the moment of about 12 Thomas Cook aircraft, all stationary on the runway. That's it. No more for them.
Hmm. That is the BBC's Gavin Lee speaking to us from Palma on the island of Mallorca in Spain. Gavin, thank you.
Speak to you soon. Bye-bye. My mama told me
you better shop around. Well, why are we playing this? It's not a message to the Thomas Cook customers. It's because at the tender age of 89 and after six decades in show business, Berry Gordy is retiring. He's the man behind Motown Records. He made his announcement yesterday back where it all started in Detroit. Gordy made household names of Stevie Wonder, Marvin Gaye, Diana Ross and the Supremes, and Smokey Robinson and the Miracles. That's who you're hearing here. And in announcing his retirement, he said it was time to spend his next 60 years reflecting on how fortunate he had been.
This message comes from NPR sponsor MindBody. MindBody connects millions to the widest variety of local fitness classes, and they offer the same experience when it comes to massage and acupuncture, spas and salons. Find, book, and pay all in one place. Owners can join the network at mindbodyonline.com/NPR. MindBody, your access to the largest consumer wellness network and marketplace.
The world's largest hotel chain says it will eliminate small plastic bottles of shampoo, conditioner, and bath gel from its hotel rooms around the world by the end of next year to cut back on plastic waste. Marriott International has more than 7,000 hotels in 132 countries following its $13 billion acquisition in 2016 of Starwood Hotels and Resorts worldwide. Arne Sorensen is the CEO of Marriott International, and he joins me now as part of View from the Top, our series of conversations with leaders. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you.
And I want to start by asking you just personally, earlier this year you announced that you'd been diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. So how are you doing?
I'm doing great, actually. I've had about 4 months of chemotherapy, which by and large went fine. It does have some side effects, but I'm in a window between chemotherapy and surgery. I feel great, actually. I've put my sneakers back on. I've been running the last week or so. I'm still very much engaged at work and maybe most importantly, optimistic about the outcome. But of course, we can't take that for granted until we're through.
Well, great to hear that. We're happy to hear that. And let's talk about your efforts most recently to reduce waste at Marriott. You're removing small plastic bottles of shampoo and other toiletries from your hotel. What kind of an impact do you think that is going to have in terms of plastic waste?
Well, we'll get to the bottom line maybe first and then talk about the process. But we think it'll be about 500 million little bottles a year
Wow.
that will be saved. And of course, those bottles today really functionally cannot be recycled because they're so small and can't be cleaned. But what we'll be using is larger bottles attached in the shower, dispensed at the volumes that each guest needs and wants, and then replaced only when they become empty. But of course, we want to make sure that these are not only environmentally sustainable and responsible, but they've got to be tamper-proof and they've got to be on brand, all of those sorts of things.
Do you think you're going to get any complaints from customers who are used to having the little bottles?
Oh, of course.
Because they won't be able to take these with them probably, right?
Generally, they will not be able to take these things with them. And I've told the story a few times when we moved my mother into assisted living the first time out of her apartment many years after my father had died. We found a very large drawer in one of her bathrooms filled with hotel soap. Now, it won't surprise you to know that most of that was Marriott hotel soap.
But that's good.
And, you know, obviously people often will take a bottle of shampoo or some soap, and that's fine. But I think most people, the overwhelming majority of people, will say this is a better experience. And I think most people understand that protecting the environment is a cause that we all share.
What about other things that you can do to reduce waste? Hotels use a lot of water. They have air conditioning running all the time. What are you doing about those issues?
Well, we're doing everything we can is the short answer. Each hotel is looking at use of heat and power, also looking at water usage, also looking at recycling. Those are common all around the world in hotel to hotel. There are some things like this toiletries thing that we can deliver for the system as a whole. But we also discovered that many things have to happen on the property level. And so we've encouraged our teams in every property around the world to adopt their own Green Council. And if we can empower them to say, do the work that you need to do at the hotel, figure out what the opportunities are, whether it's a new boiler, a new air conditioning system, or simply a new focus on recycling, that's the best way to make a difference on those individual hotels.
I want to ask you about the big merger that happened in 2016 between Marriott and Starwood, bringing the total number of brands under your umbrella to 30. Why do you need to still have Sheraton, Marriott, and Westin, for example, all as separate brands? Couldn't they all be one?
Well, it's a good question. The fact of the matter is each of those brands existed, obviously, before we acquired Starwood. And they may have been competing against each other because Starwood and Marriott were intensely competitive between the two companies. But we believe that by offering more choice to our customers when they travel, choice in terms of precise location, brand sensibility, cost, but all within the same loyalty program, that the breadth of choice keeps customers in our ecosystem as opposed to sending them to an online travel agent. So the breadth of choice is actually a good thing, and I don't think we'll ever see that it's in our interest to combine these brands.
But is it really choice for them if all the brands are owned by you?
Absolutely, it's choice because the pricing for each hotel is different. The location is going to be different, but to some extent for the sensibility of the brand too.
But I have to say, in an area like Chicago, for example, you've got the W Lakeshore by Navy Pier. Down the street, there's a Courtyard by Marriott, a Westin, a Ritz-Carlton, a Residence Inn by Marriott, a Sheraton. These are all in the same neighborhood.
I just love that you know where these hotels are.
our producers worked very hard to find a place with a ton of Starwood Marriott.
I was hoping you would say you had stayed at all of them.
I have not stayed at all of them, no. But there is a situation in Thailand, I understand, where the owner of the JW Marriott Phuket Resort and Spa is actually suing Marriott International because of the competition he's facing from other hotels within your brand.
Well, that's what he says in his complaint. Mm-hmm. Obviously we have a starkly different view about what the facts are. This is the owner of the JW Marriott in Phuket. We have had rounds of negotiations with him over the course of a 20-year relationship, which have always, from his perspective, been trying to, you know, essentially push us further aside. Mm. This has to be understood in the context of that relationship, which is, in our view, fundamentally not about our having other hotels in that market.
Let me ask you about the hack. Marriott said earlier this year that as many as 383 million guests were affected by that data breach at Starwood that was disclosed last year. What have you been doing to prevent something like that from happening again?
Well, in short, everything we can. Obviously, we were deeply disappointed to discover that hack that had happened on the Starwood reservation system before we acquired Starwood. We discovered that hack late last fall and, of course, disclosed it to our customers and to the regulators as soon as we could possibly get the facts that were necessary in order to disclose it. Since then, we've been doing, obviously, what we need to do in order to manage that crisis. But then also looking at what are the lessons we can learn from that and what are the steps that we need to implement to reduce the risk that we have further events like that. And the team's been working around the clock to do everything they can.
As someone who runs a company with hotels all over the world, what is your sense of the strength of the global economy right now? And are you worried about a recession?
I am more concerned today, obviously, than a year ago. And I think if you look around the world, it's a different story from place to place. Interestingly, Western Europe is probably the strongest market that we have as we speak. Hmm. Surprises some folks because of
Brexit.
Well, Brexit makes you think that the world must be falling apart over there. London has been performing extraordinarily well. Why? Well, partly that's because the pound is so cheap. So it is cheap to go to London today compared to normal mm-hmm. times. And so we've got more travelers coming in. That's why that market performs so well. But you can see, certainly when you look at the U.S. economy and the China economy, that both have slowed in the last few quarters. You see it both in the GDP numbers that are reported publicly. We think we see it in our business. We're still growing year over year. We're not in a recessionary environment. But we're not, in terms of same store sales, we're not growing robustly. We're a bit anxious about the way the trade war can evolve and whether or not that causes companies particularly, but potentially consumers too, to sort of revert to the sidelines.
Sort of a secondary recipient of the trouble from the trade war. It may not affect you directly, but because companies decide that they're not going to do business in certain places and therefore won't stay in hotels?
Exactly. I mean, we don't think we'll be the target of a trade war, mm-hmm. but obviously if the economy weakens in China or weakens in the United States, that weakens lodging demand.
What has the rise of Airbnb meant for you and the hotel business in general?
It's been fascinating to watch the development of this home rental space. Airbnb, of course, gets the most attention, but we shouldn't forget the fact that companies like Expedia and Booking each also have millions of home rental listings. Many of them are the same properties, actually, that are on Airbnb. In some respects, it has been surprising and gratifying to see that these platforms have often induced new travelers into travel because they've been able to offer a cheaper stay. Even as they've grown, and they've obviously grown substantially, we have continued to see occupancy in our system grow to record levels and then continue to grow from there. And absolute performance of our hotels is very, very strong. So it hasn't been cataclysmic. At the same time, we've watched what's happening in this space, and we hear from our customers that there is a part of this business that they like a great deal, but there's a part they don't like. It's too unreliable. There's too much risk that if I take a home rental, I might end up with a dirty place I'm staying. I might end up with a host that I'm not comfortable with. I might end up with a guest that leaves my property damaged. And, you know, many of the providers that have been in this space have really not tried to provide a sort of a reliable experience. And so we've decided this year that we will get into this space ourselves, but with a brandable and reliable experience.
How do you do that?
Well, we do it by making sure we've got essentially a home management company in each market that is delivering housekeeping services so that the place is clean, design services so that it is an attractive facility, and make sure the bedding is right so that people have a luxury experience. Things like Wi-Fi, make sure that that works, key delivery, and that they're standing by if there's a problem. Our focus is really to say, all right, let's try and deliver the larger unit, not necessarily luxury only, but certainly the top half or so of that market, where you can deliver experience that we're comfortable standing behind.
That is Arne Sorensen, who is the CEO of Marriott International. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Jeremy.
No matter where or when your day begins, start it with Morning Edition from NPR News. On demand, weekdays from 7 to 3. Just say, Alexa, play Morning Edition.
16-year-old climate activist Greta Thunberg spoke today at the United Nations Climate Action Summit in New York and had this message for world leaders.
You are failing us. But the young people are starting to understand your betrayal.
The Swedish teenager arrived in New York a few weeks ago on board a sailboat that uses solar when there's no wind. That's something a sailor in upstate New York has also been trying out, as Emily Russell of North Country Public Radio reports.
John Cherimella parks his sailboat at a little marina on New York's northern coast of Lake Champlain. Cherimella has a bright white beard, and he grins when he introduces me to his 28-foot baby.
There she is.
Tethys,
the Greek goddess of lakes and rivers.
The boat is white with blue trim and cheap at the price. Cherimella bought it for just $400.
Because she didn't have a motor, but that was all right because I didn't want a motor.
He wanted to build one himself, specifically an electric motor. Cherimella works in renewables. He's a solar consultant based in northern New York. We climb on board and he takes me down into the cabin where he lifts up a little hatch under the stairs.
So this compartment here was filled with a big 500-pound diesel motor.
Okay, so sailboats, they're mostly powered by the wind, but a lot of the bigger boats also have big motors in them. Diesel motors, especially the older ones, release toxic pollutants into the air and the water. So Cherimella instead installed a sleek 35-pound electric one.
But as you can see, it's tiny compared to the space of what the diesel motor took up.
There's another compartment for the lithium-ion batteries, and then on the outside of the boat, a long slab of solar panels.
So on a day like today, this sunny day, we can cruise around all day long
and the solar panels will create enough electricity to power the boat.
If we wanted to, Charamella says, we could run the motor for about 5 hours today. Fewer if the sun wasn't shining.
So can we go out?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Charamella unties the boat and turns on the motor.
That's full throttle.
You can barely hear it.
We move out of the harbor, and Charamella turns off the engine.
So quiet.
Yeah, so this is what sailing sounds like. To have this interrupted with, bah, 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 you know, this banging away diesel motor, making the whole boat shake, it's like, we don't have to stay there any longer.
He says other boats, too, can make the transition to renewable energy. It doesn't come cheap. Charamella says he spent about $13,000 on the entire overhaul. He says he did get 30% of that back in a federal tax credit. We're a couple miles from shore now, and there are big white caps breaking against the boat.
We just have half of the sail out, and we're doing probably 7 miles an hour because the wind's a steady 20.
The wind catches the sail, and the boat gets pulled up on its side.
We're tilted.
Yeah, we're heeling. This is called heeling.
It is a little scary, but in a good sort of exhilarating way. You have to move with the boat and watch for any changes in the wind. For an active sailor like Charamella, that connection between his boat and the environment is a lifestyle, one that's inspired his career in the solar industry.
I installed my first solar panels in 1977. And believe it or not, those solar panels are still working today.
Charamella is realistic. He doesn't think just getting other sailors to transition to renewables will stop climate change, but he sees it as another step forward towards a greener future. For Here and Now, I'm Emily Russell.
Neil Patrick Harris is such a dear friend. Oh, wait, I don't know him at all, but like a lot of us, I feel like I do. From the childhood doctor Doogie Howser to Barney Stinson and How I Met Your Mother to possibly everyone's favorite award show host and now author of the popular young adult series The Magic Misfits, about a ragtag gang of self-described outsider kids who bond over their love of magic and, of course, fight the villains trying to take over the otherwise idyllic resort town where they live. But in between escapades, we, the reader, get magic lessons. Yes, for instance, we finally learn how a magician knows which card you picked from the pack. Because Neil Patrick Harris is like a pro. The third book in his series is titled The Magic Misfits, The Minor Third. And Neil Patrick Harris, when we read it, it sounds like you, your voice, you having a blast with this gang of offbeat kids. What is this about besides your love of magic?
Well, my path has led me in very interesting and disparate ways in my career and in my life.
You think?
And I've gotten to act on stage and act on television and act in films. I've gotten to direct magic shows. I've gotten to host shows. I've gotten to have children. And reading and literacy and literature and the tactile book has always been something that's been really important to me growing up and as a parent even more so. So I think because I have such weird likes that kind of run all over the place, putting together a middle grade fiction series was exactly where my brain often sits. Mm. I had just finished and was doing a series of unfortunate events, Daniel Handler's series that he penned as Lemony Snicket. And I recognized his ability to not only tell a very thrilling story, but to be able to impart interesting sentence structure and a sense of humor and a vocabulary. So there was some education involved. And so this is sort of my take on that. I know magic. I live in a world hoping that it's immersive theater and that it's David Fincher's The Game, and I can somehow someone's going to pull me aside and say, quick, we need your help. You have to unlock this door using this combination, and there's a secret staircase, and inside will be an envelope, and it'll be marked, and more instructions to come. Like, that's how I would love my life to live. And so this is kind of the my version of that for intelligent middle-grade kids.
Well, who knew? We just see you as walking around looking pleasant. But inside your head, all of this is going on and you're going to leap in and save the day. And I just, you know, the kids are, you know, a diverse group. There's a girl in a wheelchair. Someone's African-American. Someone grew up in a broken home, lives with his cousin who has two dads. You're celebrating possibility and reality for a
sure.
lot of kids.
And while that's intentional, for those that haven't read the first two books, it's not something that I wanted to do and have it be the moral of the story.
Right.
In fact, what I think is nice about this reading level is that you can teach, and you're teaching a group who are very anxious to be individuals and also to fit in.
Yeah.
Right? So it's a great duality. It's a complicated one because you don't want to be singled out because it's embarrassing because you want to fit in, but you don't want to just be one of many because you're special and unique and you want to stand out.
Right.
And so magic is a great opportunity to teach a hobby that sort of is that.
Yeah.
Magic by design is not the football player and and group sports. It's a little more introspective. You have to practice and you have to study it, and then you get to perform it. It's a little potentially embarrassing to be performing in front of other people, but then you have potentially magical skills that people are impressed by.
Yeah.
And so if you can do that and also have the individual dynamics be very unique in their own way, but all of that is sort of couched in a sense of normalcy. These are the facts. Mm-hmm. We're not going to sit too deep in the fact that Layla, the escape artist girl, is adopted. We learn about her adoption and how she came to be through the plot of the story, but it's not a story about adoption and what it means to have not had birth parents. I did a thing, since it's four books and there's four suits of a deck, and I love magic, each book looks like a playing card if you look at it with the jacket on. And so the first book involves diamonds because the protagonist, Carter, meets this group in this town called Mineral Wells, and there's a giant diamond that's on display, and a carnival boss, B.B. Basso, is trying to steal said diamond. And the second book and the second suit is about clubs, and so it involves Layla, who's an escape artist, lives with Mr. Vernon, the magic shop owner, and his husband, the other Mr. Vernon, and they learn that there's a larger club that Mr. Vernon was once a part of called the Emerald Ring. So the third book that's just coming out is based on hearts. And Theo Steinmeier is a violinist and a prodigious one at that. He can also use his violin bow to make things levitate.
Yes.
And so he's having to follow his heart now in this book and figure out where his passions lie.
Well, how much fun. And also, how much magic. So let's just do one.
Okay.
So if you have a pack of cards, you memorize the card on the bottom. You call that the key card?
A key card principle, sure.
And then you split the pack, still knowing where the one on the bottom is that you know. You fan the pack out. And would you tell us how to do this? You fan the pack out and someone picks a card?
Well, I will say this. As a magician, longtime member of magical groups, the Academy of Magical Arts.
President of the Academy of Magical Arts.
President of where the Magic Castle is for 3 years. I would be remiss to, on national public radio, expose how a magic trick is accomplished.
Oh.
But I will say that there are techniques, and your listeners will probably have already sort of figured out what a key card principle would be, where you can you don't have to necessarily know what, say, the top card of the deck is. If you may have taken a peek at the bottom card and then, say, were to cut the deck, you might be able to ascertain what the card either below it or above it could potentially be.
Exactly. That is brilliant. And
now, see, but here's the thing about magic, right? So that's the explanation of the trick. But if someone were to do a trick and just say that, take a card, put it on the top of the deck, I'm going to cut the cards and I'm going to flip it over and fan through them. Was this your card? It's not an incredibly impressive trick. So part of what is fun about magic is the creation of the effect around that pretty simple idea.
I love the one about how to levitate a piece of bread. Forks are involved. I'll just say that. Well, how did you get into this?
I grew up in a small town in New Mexico, and I grew up in a time when there wasn't a lot to do but watch TV. And I grew up at a time when Doug Henning was still doing yearly magic specials, and David Copperfield, who would make the Statue of Liberty disappear. He would walk through the Great Wall of China. He would make an Orient Express train car that's surrounded by people holding hands and covered with a cloth, levitate, and then vanish. And I was riveted to the TV, but I didn't quite know how to do it. I would go to the library, and I would get books and read them and learn how to do card tricks and things. But the proper packet tricks and things that use props, I didn't quite understand until I got to Albuquerque, and there was a magic shop called Fool's Paradise. And And I was just smitten. I got to save up my allowance and I could make choices. And then on the ride home, I would open up the instructions, and that's the only way you can learn the secret. The principles behind it are psychological in many ways and required persistence, perseverance, practice. And I just think it's a great variety art to not lose. And so I go out of my way to produce, promote, and attend and shine the spotlight onto magic and magicians.
And share it in your book. So now we all know how you can make a card rise in the palm of your hand. And I'm telling you, that's cheating. I'm not going to give away what it was, but I'm sure you've been asked about this. I mean, acting is magic, and acting is make-believe.
There's a big connection between magic and acting. And I think similarly, there's magic in a lot of the things that we just do in our day-to-day interactions. Because if you think about it, when you're watching a magician perform a trick, he's explaining the facts of what's happening. Pick a card, you're going to put it in the deck, I'll shuffle the deck, the card is lost in the deck, I'm going to make it appear in an interesting way. But those are facts that he's just explaining to you. Those may not be the actual facts, right? Mm-hmm. And so in acting, there are facts of a script, but you're able to act around it and fill it in. There are facts of things that happen, and it's our jobs as humans to process what those facts mean to you and embellish upon it.
That is actor, singer, producer, writer, father, husband, magician, Neil Patrick Harris. The latest
apparent plate spinner.
Oh, yes. How does he do it all? The latest book in his young adult Magic Misfits series is The Minor Third. Neil, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
So you see, the card the person sees goes on the top of the deck. You split the deck, and now the key card that you know is next to it, it's in the book.
The board of directors at WeWork is reportedly meeting as soon as today to discuss whether to oust CEO Adam Neumann. There are concerns about some of his personal behavior and the company's finances. There was a huge drop in WeWork's valuation, and the IPO has now been indefinitely delayed. Derek Thompson is senior editor at The Atlantic. He joins us from Washington. Hi, Derek.
Hello, Jamie.
So first, what is happening with this push to get rid of Adam Neumann? Why have the board members soured on him?
I think it's useful to divide WeWork's problems into two categories, Adam Neumann and not Adam Neumann. So in the Adam bucket, we have this tall pile of governance issues and eccentricities, the most egregious to me being the name change. So he forced the company, WeWork, to officially change its name to the We Company. The company says, okay, they can't say no, he controls the company. Then he goes, oh, by the way, I happen to own the rights to the name The We Company, so you have to pay me $6 million for it. So Neumann charged his company, which he controls, $6 million for a name which he owns. It's utterly strange behavior. In the non-Adam Neumann bucket, however, you do have WeWork's financials, as you said. The company's going to lose well over $1 billion this year. It lost $1 billion last year. And it's not clear they have any path to profitability. So in the biggest picture, I think the board is upset not only with the man, but also with the math.
Well, and that sounds a lot to me like Uber under Travis Kalanick when they had a lot of problems with him and his eccentricity and also with the math. Now, just for people who aren't familiar with WeWork, just remind us what the company does and how big is it?
Sure. WeWork leases office buildings all over the world for billions and billions of dollars. Then it transforms them and it rents them to freelancers or to companies. It does this in dozens of countries, new locations opening like every day. The company made $2 billion last year and is growing really quickly. It's a big, important firm. But when it filed for its IPO, it listed its valuation near $50 billion. That number doesn't make any sense. This is a real estate and office space company, and it's asking investors to consider it a tech monopoly. It's not a tech company, and it's not a monopoly. And that's why this IPO has been such a mess. It's the gap between how this company saw itself in private markets and how public markets consider it.
You actually called it part of a great unicorn delusion. What do you mean by that?
Unicorns are billion-dollar private companies. And these companies, in a weird way, I have sympathy for them. They're stuck between two worlds. As private companies, they raise all this money with inflated visions of planetary conquest. And they get all of this money from private investors. And then when they turn public, all that money that they're spending on conquering the planet appears on profit and loss statements as losses. And so the public sees this company that in the private sector was this glorified story, and all they see is a company that's spending money willy-nilly and has no path to profit. So the great unicorn delusion is the delusion that the private sector story hour can go on forever. It can't. You can bewitch a bank, you can bewitch a billionaire or a fund, but public markets have pessimists, and it's very difficult to bewitch a pessimist.
Okay, Derek, I have to quote you back to you because this is one of my favorite quotes in recent days. I saw it on Twitter the other day. You write, "If you wake up on a Casper mattress, hail a Lyft to get to your desk at WeWork, use DoorDash to order lunch to the office, hail another Lyft home, and have Uber Eats bring you dinner, you've spent your entire day interacting with companies that will collectively lose nearly $13 billion this year." Mm-hmm. Why are all these companies that we talk about so much losing so much money?
Because of the great unicorn delusion. These companies, Lyft and Uber and WeWork and DoorDash, they're not just trying to be the biggest ride-hailing company or food delivery company in Austin or San Francisco. They want to conquer the world. Planetary conquest takes a lot of money. It takes tens of billions of dollars. So they're getting all of this money from investors. But when you spend that on an annualized basis, all of the spending just looks to the public markets like losses. So when they move from the private sector, where they can be valued at, you know, whatever SoftBank or some other investor wants to be valued at, when they move into public markets and they have to release SEC validated information to the public looks at this and they're like, wait a minute, planetary conquest is expensive. This isn't a business. This is a land war in Asia. You're going to bleed money forever. And as a result, the valuations come crashing down to earth.
Did the giants of today, and I'm thinking of Apple, Microsoft, Amazon, did they all lose money like this and falsify their promise at the beginning, just like these companies say are?
That is a great question. I think I would answer it like this. Most of the world's biggest companies start off losing money, but not all companies that start off losing money become the world's biggest companies, right? That is the fallacy at the heart of this idea that if you just lard up an investor vision or a founder vision with tens of billions of dollars, you inevitably create the next Amazon. You don't. Jeff Bezos is a one-of-a-kind genius. That kind of magic just can't be recreated with billions of dollars in investment money. We're in a period right now, as I see it, of enormous private sector investments where investors want to get behind the next Amazon. And the next Amazon just isn't necessarily materializing.
Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic. Thanks, as always.
Thank you.
And Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.